In the closing remarks of his first letter to the Christian community in Corinth, Paul reveals a practical side to his ministry. And this is what he says in 1 Corinthians 16, 1-4. Now concerning the collection for the saints, you should follow the directions I gave to the churches of Galatia. On the first day of every week, each of you is to put aside and save whatever extra you earn, so that collections need not be taken when I come. And when I arrive, I will send any whom you approve with letters to take your gift to Jerusalem. If it seemed advisable that I should go also, they will accompany me. So he's talking about a collection for the saints, and John Dowd is certainly not a saint, even less so a martyr. But I want you to think about how Paul wants that collection taken prior to when he arrives in Corinth. The collection, then it goes from Corinth to Jerusalem. And remember, at this point, the early Christian ministry was shared with a very small membership. When we hear about the Christian church in Rome, for example, there were probably about 40 to 50 people. And Rome was a big city. So very small house churches. And so there was really no need to fund a big building. They were meeting in houses. And certainly money wasn't needed for clergy. As is true with any top-heavy institution, after Christianity became an established religion, did it also need bigger funds to pay for various ranks of clergy as well as for buildings, land, and then stuff needed to occupy all of that real estate? And that's where we often miss the mark. The prosperity gospel argues in favor of those Christians who have acquired great wealth and fame, saying that even more will be given. Here's an example. At a church meeting, a very wealthy man rose to tell the rest of those present all about his Christian faith. "I'm a multi-millionaire, and I attribute it all to the rich blessings of God in my life. I remember that turning point in my faith. I had just earned my first dollar, and I went to a church meeting that very night. The speaker was a missionary. He told all about his work, and I knew that I only had a dollar bill and had to either give it all to God's work or nothing at all. So at that moment, I decided to give my entire dollar to God. I believe that God blessed that decision so long ago, so that now today I have over $10 million. He finished, and there was an awed silence at his testimony as he moved over to his seat. And when he sat down, an elderly woman sitting in the same pew leaned over and said to him, "I dare you, do it again." Jonathan Plout was the former beloved rabbi at Temple Beth Shalom in Traverse City, and he died just a few years ago from Lou Gehrig's disease. I was privileged to know this distinguished man personally, and during our time together, he reluctantly volunteered to serve as my religious advisor. Ministers definitely need religious advisors. For one thing, Jonathan asked me how long my sermons were, and I said that they were generally 20 to 30 minutes. It's great because I can look at the clock up there, and it's 6:45 right now, I think. And I don't wear a watch. He then asked me how long it took for me to get to the point of my sermon, and I told him that it all depended on the mood of the congregation and the day of the week the sermon was written, typically Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath. That's when I would write my sermons. In fact, last week I think I was talking about all kinds of rock heroes in my life. I did leave out Sue Cinco and said, "You left out Joe Cocker. What's wrong with you, John?" And I did. I'm sorry, Sue, because he's one of my rock heroes. Rabbi Plout said that his sermons are longer at first, though after editing throughout the week, the polished final edition, it stands at 10 minutes. He compared preaching to striking oil, and he said, "Do what the oil rig people do when they strike oil. Stop boring." Not that I want you to check your watches, but it's Stewardship Sunday today, so forget. This is this introduction here, so start right now if you're going to start my sermon. That's an introduction. Stewardship was a very big issue with Rabbi Plout, and I discussed this over a meal at a restaurant where the waitress unfortunately served him his salad loaded with bacon and chunks of ham. He had her take it back and re-prepare it. But he asked me, "How in the world do you Christians operate your churches with those offering plates every single Sunday? If someone doesn't like your sermon or the music or is offended during fellowship hour by the comment of a parishioner, don't they tip less, like maybe 1% instead of 10%? And I told the rabbi, as far as tipping, most Christian congregations pledge, well, the average, if you look at all the country, it's about 2% of income. Those who can give more, by the way, give more because they can, and those who give less because of different situations do so. But he responded to this in terms of the restaurant where we were having lunch, and he said, "When was the last time you went to a restaurant and tipped 2%, even if the service was lousy?" In Judaism, and supposedly in Christianity, the pay from the work you do in the world, in all things, it comes from God. The biblical premise is to return one-tenth of that amount to temple, or synagogue, and temple-related charities, and personal ministries, and personal missions, something that you want to give to personally at home and in the community and so forth. For those who have never attended services in Jewish communities, it should be mentioned that no offering is ever taken during worship. Rather, members of Jewish congregations pay dues to their synagogues outside of Sabbath temple worship, which seems to vary according to location in the country and around the world. Ever feel uncomfortable when that offering plate comes around and the person next to you puts in cash or check and you don't, because you've already sent in a substantial check, but you really feel cheap or something? I already sent mine in. Catherine, who sits right where Liz is sitting, or maybe Andrea or Cindy, right there, she's always feeling guilty. John, I already sent it in, or something like that. But there's something going on there. And there's an argument, I suppose, for the dues system. How about taking more than one offering on any given Sunday? And some visitors come by and say, "Oh, that church, they're always taking these extra offerings. And all that church wants to do is talk about money if they come to visit on Stewardship Sunday." One Jewish congregation in Illinois charges dues. And the dues for this particular congregation, I looked it up yesterday, $3,100 per household. Another here in Michigan has dues of $2,000 per household. Now, the Beth Israel congregation in Ann Arbor, which I attended a few times through the years, in Ann Arbor, Michigan, it presents a fair share system geared to household income and suggests 2% of gross income with added fees for their religious school. Temple Beth Zedek in Amherst, New York, recently changed their traditional membership dues system, and they have the following argument. We are not a membership organization like a country club or Kiwanis. We are a synagogue following ancient traditions in pursuit of a sacred mission. The goal of membership dues is to be able to pay our bills so that we can do the holy work for which we came into being. Dues were never intended to define who is in and who is out. This new pledge system we are offering is designed to give as many people as possible the opportunity to support our mission because they recognize the importance of what we do. The board of directors will no longer establish an amount you must pay in dues. No longer will anyone be asked to provide personal and private financial information to justify that dues level. The argument contained in this new way of conducting the stewardship campaign in the Jewish community concerns the variety of circumstances regarding members who can give more and other members, like single mothers or people without jobs, who give less according to their situation in life. And I should add that at the end of this form from the synagogue in Amherst, New York, it was indicated that this new campaign was conditional. In the event that the pledge system does not result in sufficient funds to run the synagogue, the board of directors will revert back to the old system. Now, my friend Rabbi Plaut said that every member of the congregations he has served recognize that Judaism is a way of life. And since God is a part of every aspect of life, if congregants can afford to give or tip more but choose to give less, in doing so, they are only hurting themselves. Well, obviously, viewing stewardship from a tipping perspective may seem to be a stretch. However, over any week or month, most of us come face to face with the question, how much should we tip? And personally, I'm never quite sure if 10% or 15% or 20% is proper in the various circumstances. At one local restaurant right here in Cadillac, with extremely reasonable prices, by the way, outstanding service too, even 20% of the bill seemed to be a cheap tip. While at another restaurant in Traverse City with excessive prices and mediocre service, 10% of the bill was exorbitant. At brunches, a 10% tip may be recommended, but the staff at these restaurants work just as hard. So possibly 15% or even 20% tips, those are more appropriate. One thing is sure. Without those tips, our restaurant workers who make terribly low wages and rely on those tips directly tied to those wages would receive virtually nothing and would be far below the current poverty line. In a New Yorker magazine article by James Siricki on tips, Thomas Keller, one of the world's most respected chefs and the owner of four high-end restaurants, decided to abolish tipping at all of his New York restaurants and replace this with a fixed service charge, which is common in Europe. And since doing this, he has been called un-American for undermining a system where waiters and waitresses are rewarded for their individual performance. Keller has argued, however, that though people say they tip to reward good service, most of the time the tip is determined only by how much the meal cost and not necessarily to the work required to serve it. In other words, there is a very weak correlation between the quality of service that people report receiving and the tips that they give. In August of 2001, just before 9/11, my family enjoyed a meal at an Outback restaurant in Seoul, South Korea. Not that we didn't enjoy kimchi, but after a couple of weeks of Korean food, it was our chance to experience some Aussie Americana in another country. The waitress, who spoke perfect English, by the way, conducted herself much like one does in the United States. She immediately established a relationship with us by introducing herself by name, asking our names, asking where we were from and why we were in Seoul. And then she sat down next to me and gave big smiles to our children. And David and Emily were just enchanted by this particular waitress. By the way, it was also our wedding anniversary, and she presented us with the gift of a free chocolate sundae. And she put a thank you on the back of the check. The service charge was included. There is no tipping. Now, you may not be aware of it. I'm sure Karma isn't aware of it, but I'm going to just say that maybe this year our stewardship committee will do the same thing. Give out their names. I think those names were already on the letter that was sent. Ask for your names, where you're from, why you have chosen to make this church a part of your life, possibly sit down next to you in the pew and put a thank you on your statements, which will already have the service charge included, and even give each family a chocolate on Sunday, which is close to the ice cream version. Today, restaurant workers in the United States make over $25 billion a year in tips, so the custom's very American. The practice of tipping did not become an established practice until after the Civil War, since it had the feel of old-world patronage, and those opposed said it fostered a demeaning, vulgar, master-servant relationship. It was not suited for a country where all were considered equals. In his 1916 polemic, The Itching Palm, William Scott described the tip as the price that one American is willing to pay to induce another American to acknowledge inferiority. In the New Yorker article I referenced earlier, James Sawicki concludes, the opponents of tipping got some very important things right. They saw that tipping was an aberration in a free market economy and that tips had a lot in common with gifts. They also understood that economics alone could not explain why customers were willing to tip. What they missed was that the very things they thought made tipping un-American, the waiter's need to cultivate a relationship with the customer and their reliance on that customer's largesse, were exactly what would eventually make tipping a powerful social norm in this country. The practice of tipping really belongs to what sociologists call a gift economy rather than a market one. The free market, at least in theory, is all about impersonal exchange. As long as you have goods to sell and I have money to buy them, we can make a deal regardless of how we feel about each other. But when it comes to tipping, who we are and how we feel, it matters a lot because a tip is essentially a gift, and we give better gifts to people we like than to people we don't. What time is it? Am I? Okay. Thanks. Thanks, Ed. Okay. I have lots of time then, I suppose. I wanted to share a few thoughts about the American practice of tipping with you for a reason, though, because it's just a chance for us maybe to ask ourselves a little bit about where it came from, why we do it, and why maybe we can't maybe change some of the practices or understand it. But of more relevance to us, how can we in our church put into practice some of the techniques utilized in that Outback restaurant, make it very, very personal. Because after all, since I've arrived here at this wonderful, beautiful church filled with all of you wonderful, beautiful people, my experience here is that we are a congregation indeed that might say something like they would at an Outback, no rules, just right, you know. So I'm asking the question about how we think and feel about Sunday morning offerings. Is it a tip? Is it a gift? Is it a fee for service? Are we paying membership dues? Is it conditional or unconditional? Is it habitual behavior? Or is it familial, in that our beloved family members are so intertwined with this edifice and the history of the congregation that we feel an obligation to make sure it survives for the future? It is a mission in that we volunteer our time and talent and money to provide for the needs of our congregation, our Cadillac community, and our world. And that it's a purpose, a cause, and that we find in this place an outpost of inclusion for various persecuted communities, including but not limited to LGBT individuals and people with mental illnesses and folks with physical disabilities and individuals with alternate lifestyles and people of color and folks with other religious beliefs and no religious beliefs at all. Which one are you? One thing can be hopefully said, we are not here to be rewarded for our good behavior, because that is all about the prosperity gospel, and it's all about the sale of indulgences, which Protestant reformer Martin Luther fought against so many centuries ago, expectations that breed the entitlements referenced in this story. Two friends, Al and Zeb, ran into each other one day. Noticing that Al was on the verge of tears, Zeb asked what was wrong. Al said, 3 weeks ago my boss gave me a $3,000 bonus. Congratulations, Zeb said. Hold on, replied Al, I'm just getting started. 2 weeks ago my uncle died and left me $50,000. My sympathies on your uncle's death, said Zeb, but what a nice gift he left you. And then last week, continued Al, I learned the IRS made big mistakes with my taxes over many years and sent me a refund of almost $1 million. Wow, excellent, Zeb. Why are you so glum? To which Al replied, this week, nothing. Nothing. The point is that the Bible tells us over and over again, and our life together says the same, that the only reward for doing God's work, the good work in the world, is doing God's work in the world. And further, if we do this work really well, we are likely to get ourselves in trouble. It is said that no good deed goes unpunished. That is to say, sometimes even when we give unconditionally in terms of time and talent and money, there is a strong possibility we will remain frustrated and underappreciated and worn out. Back in the 16th century, it is written that St. Teresa of Avila, who was having a particularly difficult day, she shook her fist at God, and she said, it's no wonder you have so few friends if this is how you treat them. Yet what seems to be true in all sacred relationships between God and human beings, in a marriage, in a devoted friendship, and in a family, is that when we enter into any loving relationship, there will be heartache and challenge and sorrow. But not to enter into these self-annihilating, loving relationships. It's not to live. When we give of our time and talent and money to the ministry and to the relationships here at Cadillac First Congregational United Church of Christ, we are promoting unconditional love in this fellowship and in the world. We are hopefully not looking to be rewarded other than, and you can bet on this, encountering a direct experience of God's presence and God's pleasure. Amen.